Hello and welcome to the Smells Like Infinite Sadness podcast. I'm your host, Michael Taylor. Those of you who don't know, I run the website, smellslikeinfinitesadness.com. It's a blog covering the best alternative rock from the 80s and 90s up to present day. I'm a proud middle-aged Gen Xer who is still obsessed with the music of his youth and loves to talk about it.
But those who've been listening to my show over the years know we also have the Smells Like Cinematic Sadness, where I dig into classic genre films, and on our latest podcast episode, we're doing a genre double dip for both music and movies when I talk to director Mike Schiff about his informative new documentary called The History of Metal and Horror. It's a fun flick which features notable luminaries from the worlds of film and metal discussing why the two genres feel so interlinked. The movie's a treasure trove of genre trivia for horror and metal, with Schiff picking the brains of the likes of Rob Zombie, John Carpenter, Kirk Hammett, Corey Taylor, Kane Hodder, Richard Christie, Dave Mustaine, Phil Anselmo, and that's just scratching the surface. In our interview today, Schiff discusses why this film took so long to make, what he found most illuminating from the interviews, some of the more controversial figures who appeared in the documentary, remembering the late Gunnar Hansen, Sid Haig, and John Schnepp, the possibility of releasing extended interviews, a possible sequel, and much more. So let's get to it. Well, first off, I just want to say I watched the movie, watched it a couple times now. I really enjoyed it. And I know that this film has been in the works for a while now. So can you kind of tell me when this got started and what took so long for it to finally get released? Because I know it's been a journey for you to get this out there.
Yeah. Basically it started back in about 2014. Kirk Hammett was putting on a convention of his own out in California. And he wanted to bring together the worlds of heavy metal and horror into one big weekend event. So so my friend Rob Lucas, who's also friendly with Kirk, he invited me to come on board, do some, you know, behind the scenes photography and video and stuff like that. So I had, you know, full access to the entire event, which was very cool. And after the weekend was done, you know, I'm kind of thinking about all the metal and horror stuff that was there altogether. And I realized that hadn't been a documentary made about this connection between metal and horror, which seems so obvious, you know, to so many people. So we started, you know, kind of talking about it a bit, and then we kind of realized that between all the, you know, celebrities on mostly on the horror side, but also on the metal side, we'd be able to reach out to people and, you know, request some interviews, and probably wouldn't be too difficult because we're already friendly with, you know, a fair amount of people like, Tom Savini, Doug Bradley, guys like that. You know, Chris Jericho, I already knew, you know, from a couple of years prior working on one of his music videos. So between us, we were able to kind of put together a list of people that would be interesting to interview about metal and horror. And so I think the first interview was with Chris Jericho back in late 2014. And then we just kind of kept going on from there. And just working with people's schedules was the tough part, of course, because, you know, it's not like a film production where you're hiring the cast and crew to be there for several weeks to get the job done. And that's it. You know, it's everyone's volunteering, they're donating their time. So I got to work around their schedule. And of course, a lot of these, you know, celebrities, especially musicians, are busy. You know, they're on the road all the time. So you kind of have to wait for either for them to be on break or for them to be in town, you know, so I'd be able to go to the venue and get an interview or something. And it was just like a lot of waiting around. And Rob Zombie just by himself took over a year, you know, to get an interview with him just because he's working on an album. He's working on it. He's, you know, doing a movie. He's on tour and all that kind of stuff. So that's probably the biggest reason why it took 6.5 years to put together a lot of that. And then also, you know, in the documentary, there's a short 13-minute wraparound film that I shot that helped set, you know, kind of set up each chapter of the documentary. So there was production involved in that. And, you know, just the life in general, you know, kind of slows things down, a couple of deaths in the, you know, family and stuff like that. So I had to put the production on hold for a little while. And then I got married, had a kid. And so it was just a lot, you know, to kind of deal with.
Well, how did the, I was going to ask you about that framing storyline. Where did you get the idea for that? And how did that kind of come about? When did you come up with that concept?
Well, from the very beginning, I realized I didn't want to just do a regular talking head documentary with, you know, B-roll and stuff like that. I wanted to do something a little bit different. And, you know, ultimately, I want to get more into narrative film features and things like that. So I kind of wanted to put a storyline together, you know, that would still sort of have a host to the documentary that, you know, a lot of documentaries have, but not a host that's just speaking directly to the audience, just setting up each chapter. I wanted it to be a storyline, not too involved, like not too many characters. There's only two, and it's hosted by Michael Berryman, who was awesome to work with. And Alex Rafala plays the lead in the film. So very early on, I realized I wanted to do a short film. I was bouncing some ideas back and forth, and then I kind of settled on this as like the second storyline that I came up with. So, I think it's a little bit different. It's just kind of changes the pace a little bit, and I didn't want to just do just a typical run of the mill style documentary with that type of structure. I wanted to do something a little more fun, a little more different.
Well, I thought it was interesting how you kind of go down different things. Like you first, you talk about, you know, horror movies in general, and then, you know, you break into how like metal musicians like horror and kind of vice versa. What was like the biggest discovery for you, or the biggest surprise or revelation when you're making this documentary about how these two genres are intertwined in some ways?
And I guess one of the biggest, I don't know if it was so much of a surprise for me, because I already knew a lot of the people that we interviewed, but mostly the horror guys are not metal fans. You know, it's whereas like all the metal guys are horror fans, for sure. But the horror guys, you know, they're a lot of them are kind of old school. You know, they're into, you know, 60s, 70s rock and roll type stuff. They're not really into metal, you know, per se. So while some of them have relationships with some of the metal artists, you know, like Doug Bradley and Danny Filth, you know, work together, and Tom Savini and Alice Cooper work together, things like that. The horror guys aren't really necessarily fans of a lot of the music, but because they kind of go so well, the two genres go so well together, there's a lot of sort of crossing paths amongst a lot of the, you know, the people on both sides. And they become friendly with each other, and a lot of the horror guys respect the art that goes into, you know, what the metal guys are doing. So they have an appreciation for that. And they, you know, and they work well together, and they're friendly with each other. But I guess that's one of the things that I kind of found out, is that there aren't too many of the horror guys that are into metal.
Of course, John Carpenter, who's always the coolest, definitely.
John Carpenter, on the other hand, yeah, he actually likes Metallica a lot. So, and probably a couple of other bands too. So he would be an exception to the rule, which is cool. But so yeah, there are a few exceptions, but for the most part, kind of worked out the way it did.
And also, I guess one thing I was kind of curious about, was there any person that you were dying to interview that you couldn't get a hold of, or did you pretty much get everybody that was on your list? It just took you a while to get a hold of everybody.
I mean, I probably got about 90% of everyone that I wanted. There were definitely a few that I tried, you know, obviously. People always ask me, hey, what about Ozzy? What about Kerry King? You know, what about King Diamond and all that stuff? And, you know, I always tell them, it's like, well, you know, if there's someone that came to your mind you feel I should have had in the film, chances are I probably tried and it just didn't work out for whatever reason. And not necessarily because it was no interest. It's just, you know, like with Ozzy, it was, you know, Ozzy's on tour. He's in the studio. He had an accident. He fell ill. And then just after, you know, maybe even a couple of years of attempts, it just kind of fell apart. And it was, you know, you just kind of get to the point where it's like, all right, it's, you know, the intentions are there, you know, people are interested, but it's just not going to happen. So there were a few on the list that didn't make it, but yeah, for the most part, I think I got a lot of the key players, you know, in these genres. So I'm pretty happy with the way it turned out.
And I also appreciate the fact that, I mean, you definitely got a lot of, you know, I'm going to say mainstream metal, but kind of the big metal acts. But I also appreciate the kind of the fringe, you know, different groups like Skinny Puppy or, you know, the Misfits, you know, mm-hmm. just getting different genres in there too, because, you know, just kind of showing that horror kind of has like a wide reach just beyond metal, but all those bands are kind of metal adjacent. So it works.
Yeah.
So I definitely like that aspect of it. What was it like working with Michael Berryman? How was he to work with, and what was that shoot with him like? Was he a lot of fun to be around, or
Yeah, he was cool. He, you know, he's the type of guy you can have a good conversation with. He's very very approachable in general. You know, if you meet him at a horror convention, you can always go up and talk to him, and he's very polite and friendly and approachable. So working with him on a professional level, of course, is very cool, you know, to be able to give direction to one of the horror legends in the business. Was a lot of fun, and he took direction very well. He was very open to everything, and just was always asking me, he's like, oh, you know, is that how you wanted it? You know, do you want me to do anything different or whatever? But he was just a natural. I really didn't have to give him a whole lot of direction, you know, just little things here and there. And because he was performing in front of a green screen, we had to have his positioning shot in various ways to match where he was going to ultimately end up in the film, you know, on the TV monitors. So that was probably the tricky part, is just making sure that the angling, you know, the angles were correct. But he did that very well. And in between, you know, just having random conversations with him was, you know, it was pretty cool. So yeah, Michael's great. And it was probably like maybe a half day shoot. He just flew right into Burbank. We shot at my friend's studio, got through half the day, and then he flew back home the same day, and was very, very quick and easy, which was great.
And one thing I thought was interesting, and I was very curious to ask you about this, was, you know, obviously you shot this, you know, several years back before certain things happened, and watching the Marilyn Manson and Twiggy interviews, I was wondering, were you kind of contemplating, should I take them out or should I keep them in, or I've got them on tape, I want to keep this on record, or did you have any misgivings or any conflict on that?
I mean, it was a discussion afterwards. I mean, we filmed Twiggy, you know, Jordy White, back when, before a lot of the controversy happened on his end. This was even before Manson ended up in all his troubles. And I did try to get Manson as well for the documentary, but he just wasn't interested. He doesn't do a whole lot of interviews in general, so it wasn't a big surprise or let down or anything. But Jordy, I mean, Jordy was great, and he was one of the nicest guys that I ever met. And he probably sat down with us for over an hour, very generous with his time. And but yeah, I mean, you know, he ended up in some controversy from his past, and I was thinking about that. But at the same time, you know, it's I wasn't there. I mean, it's not like there was a huge trial where, you know, who's found guilty of some horrendous thing. It was like those guys, they were wild guys, you know, and I knew sort of about, you know, the relationship back in the day in the early 90s. And I know it was crazy. It was drugs everywhere. There's a lot of just madness, you know, amongst those guys. So, you know, so I try not to judge or try to, you know, just assume I know the full story, you know, and everything. And all I knew was who Jordy was based on how I met him and how I interviewed him and how, you know, gracious he was towards us. So I really didn't think at all about removing him from the film. I think his contributions to the film were worth keeping for sure. You know, obviously if there was someone who was found guilty of some really egregious crime or whatever, that might have been a different scenario. But in this case, I felt it was still worth keeping him in there.
It's tricky nowadays, you know, because it's this whole, somebody did something bad, let's wipe them off the map, basically, kind of a thing. But I mean, I actually met him and Marilyn Manson years ago after seeing a show, and they were both very nice to me and were pleasant to talk to. So it is one of those things where it's like, you just don't know. We weren't there, but I did think that he had some interesting observations. But I was just kind of curious, and even Phil Anselmo had his kind of issue, but he seems mm-hmm. to have moved past that. It's interesting.
Well, sorry to cut you off, but actually what was interesting about that is that Phil's thing happened prior to, you know, to Jordy's, and I was actually talking to Jordy about it. I was like, hey, you know, sorry, you heard about this thing that happened with Phil, you know, and everything. I was like, man, you know, like, I'm not really sure. Like, what should I do? Do you think this is going to blow over? Do you think it's going to be an issue? And he's like, you know, it's probably just going to blow over and no one's going to be really thinking about it for much longer. So it's actually interesting that I had that conversation with him, you know, before his whole situation happened. But yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. You know, sometimes I mean, in Phil's situation, you know, he was a little intoxicated. He was a little belligerent and stuff happened. And he said some things that he certainly shouldn't have. But I also think that, you know, for the most part, you know, people are good and they deserve some, you know, recognition for their mistakes. And if they clean up their act, I think they're deserving of some forgiveness too. So, you know, I try not to judge too harshly or anything, because Phil's always been like one of the nicest guys I ever met. Every time I see him, you know, he remembers me and, you know, gives me a big hug and everything. So it's, and I see how he is around a lot of people, and he's just, he's one of the kindest guys. So it's just, you know, you kind of have to, you know, base your perceptions on how people are overall and not just some of the few mistakes that they make in life, you know, which I know that they try to fix, you know, for the most part as best they can.
Yeah, it brought me back because I interviewed him when he did the first House Horror Fest in Austin, because that's where I live.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's where I shot his interview and a bunch of others.
Oh, okay. Yes, we were in the same arena.
Was it the last one? The last one they did?
No, I didn't do the San Antonio. I did the two prior.
Okay, so I wasn't at that one. I was at the very last one they did.
And it just kind of made me a little bit sad. So I was like, I wish he was able to keep that going, but I know his, you know, I remember the day after they showed Texas Chainsaw Massacre over in the Austin show that his collaborator died of a heart attack. And, and that kind of, basically, I think without his direction, Phil kind of felt overwhelmed by it. But yeah, I had the same feeling interviewing him. He seems like a pretty down to earth, you know, much more friendly than you would expect, I think, given his reputation. But so I thought you got some great stuff out of him. Did you have any highlights as far as who you interviewed? Like, did you have a personal favorite interview, or was anybody more difficult to get stuff out of than others, or was it all pretty equal?
I mean, there was, you know, some of them were, you know, they just, I guess, spoke a lot more, you know, information just kind of flowed out of them, you know, a lot more than others. I mean, there's, you know, some interviews lasted less than 10 minutes and others lasted over an hour, you know, so it really depended, because I had pretty much the same amount of questions for everyone. So, so some were either just very brief in their answers and they just didn't really elaborate much, and they just gave very quick answers, or they're on a time crunch and we just had to pick, you know, some of the best questions for them to answer. So it's kind of a wide range. I mean, you know, interview length goes, you know, anywhere from under 10 to over an hour and everything. So one thing that I'm actually working on now is putting together all the uncut interviews. So because there's probably 25, 30 hours worth of material that's,
Yeah,
that's kind of sad. I mean, you know, you sit down with Alice Cooper for an hour or so. I mean, that's a lot of material that didn't make it into the actual film, which I'm sure a lot of people would like to see at some point. So so I'm going to make all those available. I'm going to package those and everything. So, you know, there'll be some interviews that are really short and some that are much longer. So it'll just be a wide range of lengths of interviews.
That's great, because I know it's so painful having to cut some of that stuff out, because you get like those perfect sound bites and then you're like, but I have to only have so much time to make this thing where it's not, you know, 12 hours long. But so that's great you can do that, and I'm so glad you were able to get Rob Zombie eventually, because I mean, he's like the perfect person because he's in both worlds. So I thought he gave some good perspective on that, and it was interesting to listen to. You know, another thing that got me was just, you know, the people that we've lost since you started making this thing, you know, Sid Haig and Gunnar Hansen, and his name escapes me. You you thanked him you get a tribute for him in the credits. He was
John Schnepp.
Yes, yeah, the critic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of talking to Gunnar Hansen years ago, and he was the most sensitive, nicest person in the world. Did you find that when you talked to him as well? Yeah. He's very insightful, I think, and just he was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Very intelligent man, nicest guy. And, you know, we had met, I think, for the first time that day that I interviewed him. So it was pretty, you know, not a very long interview, but it was a good one. And right afterwards, he's like, hey, you know, and we shot it at the hotel, the convention and where everyone was staying at. And he said afterwards, you know, having just met us really for the first time, he's like, hey, you know, I'm going to be up at the bar in a little while. If you know, you want to go grab a beer and hang out. Or, you know, I just thought it was like the nicest thing. Cause I mean, he, you know, obviously we had a good, relationship, you know, that afternoon when we filmed the interview, but, for him to still want to kind of continue and hang out and talk more, I thought was really cool. And I mean, you'll never meet anyone who said, you know, that they had a bad experience meeting him. I mean, everyone who meets him just, you know, sees what a genuine, nice guy he was. So he was a great loss. And of course, Sid as well. And John, it was, you know, really sad to lose all those guys. I was just fortunate enough to get them involved in the project before they passed. And, unfortunately, none of them were able to see it, they passed before I was even done with production. But yeah, they were great. And unfortunately, that's just kind of how life is. You just never know.
Yeah. Well, I loved his observation, or Gunnar's observation about Texas Chainsaw being like a post-apocalyptic film. I never saw it that way before, but now that when I'm thinking about it, it totally does feel like the kind of the end of civilization in some way. I mean, I live in Texas. I've driven through places in Texas that feels like you get stopped by those people. So, yeah. So that was, I thought that was some insight from him. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. And the cool thing too about him is that he's also, he wasn't a metal fan, at all, but he was able to put that connection together between metal and horror. And that's why I didn't even have to really coach him on that answer. But he, you know, he said that that's sort of the similar, like why, it's kind of similar to metal in a way. It's like post-apocalyptic. It's, you know, the end of the world. And then he kind of saw metal as being like that, just chaos and madness and everything, similar to the movie. So though he wasn't a fan, he was still able to really recognize that connection and speak on it. So that was pretty cool.
And I feel like I'm being a terrible name dropper. I'd say who I interview, but I had to mention that I interviewed Richard Christie a few years back and he mentioned you during the interview.
So
did you used to work for the Howard Stern Show? Is that right?
Yeah. I was there for about 8 years. So that's how I knew Richard. And of course, without Richard, this whole thing would have never happened, because he introduced me to our mutual friend, Rob, who ended up being the producer on the film, and he introduced me to Kirk and kind of helped get the whole ball rolling. So I give a lot of credit to Richard for just making introductions and everything. You know, but he's Richard's a great guy, and I worked with him also on his music videos. I did two of his music videos, which are Walls of the Damned. So we'll work together, and that's also how I ended up meeting Brian Slagle from Metal Blade. So that's sort of how that introduction happened as well, and that's how we got Brian involved in the film also. So it's just relationships, really. Just it's who you know. It makes life so much easier, and as far as getting things done.
I have the Too Much Horror Business book, but I was so blown away seeing his collection, like, you know, in person. It was really cool also hearing from, like, you know, Karloff and Lugosi's, you know, offspring or grandsons or but just hearing how even they were, like, you know, impressed by it. Like, I thought it was cool. I mean, given their age, that they were still like receptive to horror. And not being like, oh, now it's this and that. I like their perspective on it. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, hearing about, you know, Bela Lugosi Jr. going to a metal show, you know, at Kirk's festival, and it's like, you know, could you imagine, you know, seeing him just in the crowd, just you know, listening to the music and getting into it and stuff. But he had a great time, and they had a lot of fun. But yeah, they're all great, and they've emailed me as well, just saying how much they appreciate you know, me keeping the family's legacy alive through projects like this and everything. And that was really you know, amazing to hear from the families of the legends, you know, the original legends in the horror world. So I was very fortunate to get, you know, someone from each family involved in the film.
Were you able to get any theatrical screenings at all for this? Or was it just a straight to you know, Blu-ray and streaming, or were you able to get any screenings, or did you try to arrange any, or?
I think I kind of dabbled in that a little bit. Documentaries are hard, you know, to fill seats. So I didn't really push too much, because you know, you have to rent out a theater, and then you take a loss if you don't fill it and all that kind of stuff. And I just didn't really feel it was necessary. I hit the festival circuit pretty heavy. So I did tons of festivals. So it got shown on a lot of screens that way. I had one screening mostly for friends in Pittsburgh, because a lot of my friends are out there. So I did one screening in Pittsburgh at a theater, which was pretty cool. But there was a Steelers game going on that night too, so I had to kind of compete. and they're very serious about their Steelers, so I couldn't compete too much. But at least I had all my friends there, and Tom Savini was there, which was very cool. So I really didn't do the theatrical thing. I felt like it wasn't probably worth my time or money to really do. So I did the festivals, and then I started just working on a couple of distribution deals here and there. And so now it's on physical media and streaming on various platforms. So I'm pretty happy with that. Of course, if anyone offered, to have it at their theater, if they had one, then sure, I'd be open to it. But I'm not going to start spending a bunch of cash renting out theaters and doing that whole thing myself.
Well, it's fitting that you did a screening in Pittsburgh. It's a pretty perfect location to, given George Romero's legacy and all of that.
Yeah, for sure. And I wish I could have gotten George for the film too, but unfortunately he passed as well. But he was also a very, very friendly, approachable guy.
Have you gotten much feedback yet on the film from people, or have you heard any reviews or any feedback from those that you show to at conventions and things like that?
Yeah, and it's mostly good, which is nice. I mean, whenever you make a movie and you put in years of your life working on something, you never want to read that one bad review.
No.
I mean, it's like you can get tons and tons of great ones, and then you get one bad one. It's kind of a downer. But for the most part, I mean, even the reviews that are on Amazon are close to 5 stars, I think. And, I've got tons of just praise from people directly through social media and various other platforms, and I've won probably 25 awards, and then I've been nominated for another 25 on top of that, so close to 50 award wins and nominations. I think is not too bad. So I look at all that stuff, and then if I do see something negative that somebody didn't like it for whatever reason, I'm like, oh, that's fine. That's everything. Look, I don't, one of my least favorite mega blockbuster movies, Terminator 2. I can't stand that movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Love the first one, hated the second one. And everyone's like, how could you not? It was the most amazing movie ever made. But I'm just like, it wasn't for me. It wasn't a bad movie. It just wasn't for me. So when I see people writing honest reviews saying that they don't like it, then it's totally fine, because I don't like Terminator 2. So.
That's funny you mentioned that. I do like Terminator 2, but I definitely agree the first one is definitely better. I think the second one is great for the visual effects primarily, but the first film I think is just more satisfying. So
the effects were not as fancy, and the action and all that stuff, but the characters were so good. It was so well written. And again, it's the second one, then it kind of becomes Terminator story, which I just couldn't stand. And once I want all the heroes to die, I'm lost. I'm out of the movie. I can't, I'm like, please let them all just die already. Let the T-1000 win and just sail off, melt off to the sunset or something, because I can't stand any of these other characters. So,
when do you think that you'll be able to release those extra interviews? When do you anticipate those coming out?
Working on it. I'm probably over halfway through. It's going through them all over again, for the most part, and just cleaning it, taking out the, us asking the questions and taking out any kind of major sound issues or whatever. But for the most part, I'm leaving it pretty raw. I'm not doing color correction. I'm just, it's all going to be pretty much black and white, to avoid all that. And everything's just going to be kind of monochrome and kind of grainy and not a lot of sound cleanup or whatever. It's just going to be pretty raw. But it still takes time. I still got to go through all that stuff, put it together, export it, upload it. But I think probably in a couple of months, I'm going to try to make those available. So I'm not sure if I'm going to do physical media, because then that gets, that's a big process. You got to have a multi-disc set to put together, which I'm sure I'll do. But I'll probably have them up streaming first before anything, because it's so easy, and I could just do it myself up on Vimeo. you'll be able to watch like all the different interviews will be listed there, and you can just rent or buy whichever one you want, or buy the whole package or whatever. So that's sort of the good thing about not necessarily signing the film away, you know, to distributors. It's like I maintain control, so I can still do whatever I want with the footage. So maybe a couple of months, I'd like to have it out.
I know that they recently did a documentary. I'm drawing a blank. It was all about 80s horror, and they started with one, then they made a second one, they made a third one. They're all like 3 hours long, which is crazy, but I'll think of it as soon as I hang up with you. I'll think of it.
In Search of Darkness.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So have you thought about doing like a sequel, like the History of horror Metal Part 2, or you think that the extra interviews are just going to be, that's going to be kind of the end of it?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I get asked about it every now and then, and I always try to think, you know, if there's enough of a demand for something like that, I'll definitely think about it. I'd be curious to know what else people would be interested in seeing, you know, on top of that, because I feel like I kind of covered the whole history, you know, of metal and horror and why they go together. So I'd have to think of a totally different angle of you know, what would I fill up that time with? If I already got all these people interviewed, who else would I get? You know, maybe a few that I didn't get the first time, but, you know, I probably wouldn't go back and re-interview a lot of the same people for a sequel. So I'd have to see if there'd be any other sort of angle that I could pursue. I'm open to it. You know, I just need to kind of figure out what that might be.
And in addition to releasing these extra interviews, are there any other projects you have in the works or anything else that you've been working on recently?
I'm always thinking about stuff. I have a couple of screenplays that I've written over the past few years, and I was kind of putting them on hold because getting a film done without being like a major, you know, name in the business is tough, you know? So I was kind of looking at this documentary as sort of maybe a way to sort of establish myself a little bit, get my name out there, build some relationships, and then maybe, you know, consider pursuing, getting these into production if I can sort of get a team together to make it happen. So I have a couple of features that I've written, and maybe we'll do that. Maybe I'll do another doc about something totally different, you know, or definitely it would be kind of horror related, I think. So we'll see. I'm not too sure yet. I'm still, still doing some of the festival circuit on this one. I'm heading over to Sitges next month in Barcelona, which is going to be great. So that's like the big festival that everyone wants to get into. So I was fortunate to be part of that. So that's going to be, that'll be interesting, and, you know, make some connections there and stuff. But after that, I don't know. We'll see.
Very cool. Well, I really enjoyed the movie, and it's great talking to you today. I really like hearing all your insight and stuff. It's really, really fascinating. So thanks for taking the time out, and good luck with the film. I keep rolling it out, and keep me posted on those interviews when you put those out. I'd definitely like to see that as well.
Yeah, and I'm going to be posting stuff on social media to let people know. And, so at The Metal Horror on the Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter is where people can find more about it. And metalhorror.com is the website. And I'm also selling DVDs, Blu-rays, and posters out of there directly. So I actually ship them out myself. So if anyone wants to go there, then that's even better for me than getting it on Amazon or whatever.
I get you. I totally understand. Well, I'll get the word out. Yeah, and thanks for your time today. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, take care.
All right, take it easy.
Thanks to Mark for taking the time out to do this interview. You can order his new movie, The History of Metal Horror, via his website, metalhorror.com. It also lists all the various streaming platforms on the website you can stream the movie on. So hope you all enjoy this episode, and stay tuned. We've got some more good stuff for October, some more horror movie stuff, and maybe another interview with a certain rock star in the works. So stay tuned for that. Until next time, stay safe and stay sane.